More than likely, today, sometime this week, sometime this month, you will be sitting at a table in a place that's not your home, and you'll have in front of you a menu. And this menu has a list of all kinds of items that you can choose from. How do you make your selection? What you're going to eat for the day? I still remember an old show that one of the characters in the show was sitting at a table in a restaurant with all her friends and trying to decide what she wanted. And so she was gonna choose what she wanted. And then the first friend put their order in, and she decided, well, I'm gonna change my order. I'm gonna have what they're having. Can you change my order, waiter? Can you change it so I can have what they're having? Okay. All right. Scribbles it out. Next friend puts their order in. And then this lady speaks up. You know what? Actually, I'm going to change my order again. Can you put my order? I want what she's having. You know, I want what that next friend's having. And it went around to four or five different people around the table. By the end of it, you know, the waiter wants to throw out the whole menu, the order slip and all of that. And it's all dramatic and everything. And you may be that kind of person where it is hard for you to make a decision. What criteria do you use to make a decision? What are the factors that are involved in whether I should do this or shouldn't do this? What are the ingredients that can help you and help me to be able to make a decision that is completely honoring to the Lord, completely authentic to His purpose in my life, and that will gain the greatest glory for our Lord and King? You know, in Genesis chapter 38, if you will, turn to Genesis 38. Because of this content in the chapter, because of the congregation we have this morning, I will just abbreviate some of the material in this chapter. The story is sordid. The story is a little bit dark. The story is disappointing. But when you go from chapter 38, and then you read chapter 39, you are forced to recognize that there is a parallel between these two chapters. Chapter 38 is all about Judah, the fourth son of Jacob. Chapter 39 is all about Joseph. Chapter 38, Judah is in a strange place. Chapter 39, Joseph is in a strange place. Chapter 38, Judah is faced with some moral decisions. Chapter 39, Joseph is faced with some moral decisions. And you look through the chapter over and over and over again, you're going to find there's all kinds of different parallels between these two stories, and they are designed to show us a couple different things. Number one, I believe that what we'll see is there are a lot of different choices you can make. We're going to see that Judah makes a whole lot of wrong decisions. Joseph makes a lot of spectacular decisions. You're going to see also that God is working in both men's lives. Because the way that this story ends is just a beautiful thing, because it is a testimony of the grace of God, which is what this book of Genesis is all about. God giving us the opportunity to be what He created us to be for His honor and for His glory. That is what grace is all about. In Genesis chapter 37, we left the scene where the brothers had decided, let's not kill our young brother, Joseph, this dreamer of dreams. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and let our hand not be upon him. Judah was the one who spoke up at that point. If you remember, Judah's the one that's sitting around with the brothers. Simeon has walked off, and Judah says, hey guys, I got a great idea. You see that band of merchants that are going through? What if we just sold Joseph? We could make some money off of him. Our hand wouldn't be upon him. And when you read in the passage, it's almost an emphasis of, well, he probably will end up dying, but at least it wouldn't be at our hand, and that his blood would be required at our hand. And so the brothers think, hey, this is a great idea. Let's sell Joseph. And then I wonder if there was this sinking feeling of, well, how are we going to explain this one to Dad? We don't know who was the brainchild behind the story that was told to Dad. It's that all of them worked together on this, but they took that cloak, that famous coat that Joseph had worn, that Dad had given him, they soaked it in goat's blood, and then they presented it to Dad and said, Dad, this looks like maybe Joseph's coat. Could you confirm whether or not this is his coat? Jacob falls to pieces. You look at verse number 35. And it says, and all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Jacob was inconsolable. And you have to wonder, I want you to kind of put yourself into the emotional climate of what's going on at that home. Can you imagine for the next several days, maybe even the next few weeks, as the brothers are up and around, dealing with the flocks, taking care of business there with the sheep and the goats, if all of them kind of look at each other, they all know what the other one's thinking. We did something pretty ornery. We did something pretty wicked. But let's not bring it up because the sting and pain of our conscience can't bear it. Deep inside, they know. One of the brothers easily gets frustrated and set off easily. And finally, he just gets composure. And he says, guys, I'm sorry. I've been really struggling. Other brothers are sullen and quiet. There's not really a heart to have any festivity or joy or celebration. I wonder, as they continue to encounter dad, and dad is just beside himself with grief, maybe as they walk by the tent of Jacob, they still hear the whimper of their father inside as he's still mourning 30 days later, more than likely, the death of his son, Joseph. And I wonder to what extent that drove Judah to make the next dozen choices in his life. You see, in Genesis chapter 38, we read, and it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah is possibly, we don't have all the context, but I do know that based on human nature, there's got to be something that Judah says, you know what? I'm just sick and tired of feeling this way. I feel like, man, if I could just blow this joint, if I could get out of this place, if I could run away from where all the bad feelings are, if I could just have some new scenery, if I could get to a new vantage point, maybe I'd begin to feel a little bit better about myself. It is possible that Judah just says, I am getting out of here. I can't stand dad blubbering. I can't stand the guilt. I can't stand the pain of my conscience. I'm going to put that behind me and I'm going to find some new and exciting experiences. I guarantee you, the moment you make that decision, the devil is going to have a friend waiting for you. The devil will have that friend, and this friend's name is Hira. Hira was there, the Adullamite, and Hira was there ready for Judah, and he sees Judah coming into the area of Adullam. This is an area of Canaan, and Hira sees him, and maybe Judah wasn't quite ready to talk about it. He wasn't really to spill his guts to Hira, but Hira knew this guy needs some help, and Hira, this Canaanite, says to Judah, hey man, I know what we'll do. I'll show you a good time. I'll get you to a point where you can forget about all your worries. You can forget about all your problems. Hira tells Judah, we're going to go and do all kinds of things. And we see that in verse number 2, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in unto her. And right away in verse number 2, you see Judah leaves home. He finds this friend, and then there's this woman, this Canaanite woman. Now, when you're reading through these stories, they are designed to make you reflect on things that have happened before. Who else? Who else disappointed his mother and father and went and married a Canaanite woman? Esau. And believe it or not, as you read through chapter 38, you're going to see over and over and over again that Judah is following right in the footsteps of Uncle Esau. Judah is living this life. He's turned his back on the way things were. He's turned his back on the way that his family used to be. He's allowing himself to just kind of flow into whatever happens. He has 3 sons with this Canaanite woman. The first son is Ur. The second son's name is Onan. And the third son's name is Shelah. As these sons grow older, he comes to the point where Judah says, I've got to pick a bride for my oldest son. And he picks this woman named Tamar. Oh man, can you imagine the festivities in this Canaanite land? All the reveling and all the joy and celebration of this new union as Ur and Tamar are married. But because Judah had relinquished his responsibility of training up his home into the paths of Abraham, his father, as the follower of God. Ur is a wicked man. We read that in just a few verses later, God just kills Ur. Can you imagine that scene? Tragedy falls upon the home. Tamar's in the corner. She is crying uncontrollably. No doubt Judah's memory is going back to Father Jacob that was crying uncontrollably. All these memories are so sensitive. Those things that he had suppressed for years, those things he had put down and tried to hide and cover up, all of a sudden they're peeking through as the shards of his life begin to fragment and separate. It's unmistakable as he sees Ur's body. God killed him. According to the custom of that day, Judah now looks to Tamar and says to his second oldest son, Onan, Onan, Tamar is now your wife. It's your responsibility to raise up a son who will stand in the place of your brother, Ur. You can read this story for yourself, but basically Onan is not interested in fulfilling that responsibility. Onan realizes that because Ur is now dead, now Onan is the one who's supposed to receive the birthright. And here again, we have a struggle between a birthright. Who's going to get the birthright, the older brother or the younger brother? Older brother's dead. Now I'm going to get the birthright. And Onan makes a decision that he is going to thwart the way things ought to be for his own selfish gain. God kills Onan right there on the spot. Now, if you have two sons that have died, and both of them have been married to Tamar. What's the easy thing to do at this point? The easiest thing to do at this point is to kind of give the hairy eyeball to Tamar. I know why they died. The old battle axe, you know, that's why they died. It's her fault. We're going to blame somebody. And so the somebody we're going to blame is Tamar. And so in the story, we see Judah looks at Tamar and says, hey, Tamar, I know I got one more boy, but he's kind of young, you know, a little green behind the, you know, you're just, how about you go back home with dad for a little while, live in your widowhoodishness, and I'll send for you. Okay. Goodbye, Tamar. I worked that one out. Judah thinks to himself, and he has this plan all settled and done. All the good years seem to go by in a flash. Judah's had three sons. He doesn't realize it, but the last 7 years have been bountiful. The last 7 years, I mean, the fields have just produced, the sheep and the herds have just produced amazingly, but then all of a sudden there's this switch that flips. He can't quite figure out what's going on, but there is a change in the weather. There's a change in the climate, and all of a sudden there begins this year that's just totally different than any of the years before. There's a drought, there's a famine, there's difficulty, there's oppression, there's all this that's going on. It's ruining everything. The field doesn't even bear anything. It's so bad that all the store that we had put up years before is starting to be eaten through. Judah is beginning to grow concerned. It was easy to be out on your own when things are going well, when the table is full of food, when it seems like life's going your way, but now two sons later who've died, and now this sudden famine. I wonder if at this point, Judah begins to dream about maybe going back home. Before he does, though, sadly, his wife dies as well. Now, when you look at that, two sons die and a wife dies. What other story in Scripture does that kind of make you think of? It's a little bit on the inverted side, but I think of Naomi. Didn't Naomi go to a strange land? She had two of her sons die, and her husband dies. And that's what broke her to such a point to where she says, I'm going to return back home. Judah takes his son, Shelah, wife is dead, goes back. And as he goes back home, possibly he hears that Father Jacob's sending all the brothers down to Egypt. Why? Why is he sending them down to Egypt? What's going on in Egypt? He comes to find out that that there's this famine that's spread across all the land, and it's been so bad that people are eating through their storehouses, and if we don't do something soon, then we're going to be totally out of food. We need to act now. And the brothers are about to take this caravan to Egypt to get food, and Judah just happened to come in at the right time. Judah joins them. He gets on the caravan, and he's heading down to Egypt with them. Judah's down there in Egypt, and he realizes there's this ruler there in Egypt. He's really a mean guy. This ruler down there in Egypt is answering Judah and his brothers like they're spies. This ruler in Egypt throws him in prison for a few days. This ruler in Egypt is just so gruff and rough with these brothers. This ruler in Egypt demands that they present the other brother that they left back at home, brother Benjamin. Judah is just beside himself, and all the brothers are too. All the while that they're in this circumstance, they are all whispering one to another, "It's because of what we did to Joseph. We're getting this because of what we did to Joseph. This is our recompense for what we've done." Judah remembers why he got away from home, why he wanted to get all of home behind him. He was tired of his conscience being pricked by what he knew deep down inside. They're right. They're right. We're getting our just dessert because of what we've done. Judah returns home. They have some food, but as they open up their grain sacks, they find that the money they had taken down to buy the grain has been replaced in their sacks. The brothers just can't believe it. What is going on? How can this be? Instead of seeing a blessing, they see that this is God's curse, that ruler is going to fine them for stealing, for theft, for all these other injustices. And it's not their fault. They don't deserve this except for what they did to Joseph. But as Judah approaches home, a messenger rushes up to him and says, Judah, Tamar. What about Tamar? Tamar is expecting a child. Judah's blood boils. I can't believe it. He boils and he rushes over to that town in Canaan. He demands that Tamar will burn at the stake. As they're putting the pyre together to burn this witch and harlot, Tamar sends a message to Judah ahead of time. You know, Judah had all but forgotten. A few months earlier, when his wife had died, good old Hira showed up again. Oh, that buddy of his from so long ago. Hira shows up and realizes Judah's down in the pits again. Judah is suffering and struggling. And he says, "Judah, come on, man. Let's go to the sheep shearing festival. It's always a grand time. It'll kind of put your mind at ease. You'll have a grand time when we go to the sheep shearing festival, and it'll be a time of celebration." Hey, in Canaan, they had different practices where women of the temple would make themselves available so that through their giving to these women of the temple, their herds would be blessed and their fields would be blessed. It was a magical practice that was supposed to take place there in the sheep shearing festival. Judah goes down, and sure enough, there was one of these women of the temple. Judah goes to that woman of the temple, and that woman of the temple says, "What will you pay me?" He says, "Oh, I'll give you a goat." She says, "You have no goat. How do I know you'll give me that goat?" Judah says, "Well, I've got my signet ring. I've got some bracelets here, and I've got my staff. These are all things that identify who I am, and I'll pledge them to you, and I'll send the goat afterward." Later, Hira takes that goat but can't find that woman. That was a few months ago, but it was not even in vivid memory to Judah any longer. But then all of a sudden, he sees clutched in Tamar's hand as she's being dragged to that pyre to be burned for her immorality. She holds up the tokens and she says, "By whose these are, I am with child." Can you imagine how broken Judah is at that moment? What I've detailed to you is a hypothetical, a possibility of how the timeline of Judah is subsequently moving in the same time of Joseph's time in Egypt. Because in verse 1 of 38, we see it came to pass at that time. All these events are kind of happening at the same point. But for some reason, Judah made choice after choice after choice that led him further and further and further into darkness until he could barely find his way out. While Judah is living this nightmare, Joseph is in Egypt. Joseph's in a strange place. Joseph doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know why his brothers did all this. He doesn't even deserve this. And as Joseph is standing there on that slave block in the land of Egypt, there's this one dignified man who comes by and maybe prods at Joseph's teeth and kind of, you know, hits his abs and kind of checks his shoulders and his knees, makes sure his joints are good. And well, he looks like he's got some good teeth and he looks like he's not gotten any ailments or physical problems. Sure, I'll buy that one. Come to find out the man's name's Potiphar, and Joseph follows Potiphar to his house, and Joseph's put to work, and job after job, Potiphar's amazed. Joseph is industrious. Joseph is reliable. Joseph is a man that you want to be on your head of staff. And before you know it, Joseph rises in the house of Potiphar, and Potiphar allows everything to be under the hand and control of Joseph. He trusts everything to Joseph except for his food. And you say, what about his food? Was Joseph not a good cook? It probably was all about the sacrifices to the idols. And I wonder if Joseph politely declined with Potiphar. Dear Potiphar, I am a man who worships a God, one God. You do not see him. He has no form. He's the one who created all the world. Potiphar, I will do everything I possibly can to serve you, but I'd ask to be excused from the one responsibility of handling the food, because it requires to be offerings to the idols. I wonder. Potiphar entrusts everything to Joseph's hands except his food. But everything that's entrusted to Joseph, he's not even worried. Potiphar's not even worried about his wife. And in Genesis 39, we see over and over and over again, verse 7, it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said unto his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There's none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business, and there was none of the men of the house there within. Potiphar's wife had laid the trap. And she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. He left his garment in her hand, and he fled and got him out. And it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house and spake unto them, saying, see, he, speaking of Potiphar, hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And you know the rest of the story. Joseph finds himself in the pit of prison. You look at these two stories that more than likely are following at the same time frame, just in two different areas, two different people, but two very similar paths. One chooses over and over what leads him further and further into darkness and to regret. The other one chooses over and over to lead to a path that is completely different. What's the difference? What's the difference? You have to say that, isn't it amazing to see Joseph with this kind of righteousness? Think about who Joseph's related to. For crying out loud, I mean, you go back in the heritage of Joseph, he's got all kinds of great characters to look up to, right? I mean, we don't even talk about what Reuben did to his dad and to his dad's wives. We won't even go to all the detail of what Simeon and Levi have done as they totally massacred a whole city in cold blood. We don't even have to look at Jacob and Esau when they were kids and all the stories of what they did and what they experienced. And then all of a sudden you have this bright shining light, Joseph, who doesn't waver one moment from the path of righteousness. What's the difference between the two people? What's the difference between their two situations? I want to give you three criteria that will help you to make the decisions that will align with what Joseph does instead of what Judah does. The first decision is based on ease. And let me encourage you that we should search the heart instead of the surface of appearance. Search the heart instead of the surface of appearance. Judah had lived completely by the surface. He saw that Canaanite woman. And just like Samson and Timnath saw that woman, said, I'm going to have her, get her for me. Judah lived by that same principle. He saw the surface of appearance, and boy, he was there. He saw the surface of appearance. Tamar had been with two sons. Two sons have died. Must be her fault. Judah had judged everything by the surface of the appearance. He never for a moment said, God, would you search my heart? And would you know if there's any wicked way in me? However, Joseph, he was the one that looked deep into every situation. He knew there was something deeper and more meaningful behind every single decision he made. There was something important that he had to decide. And Joseph was a man who would look at that and say, you know what, Potiphar's wife, your husband has given me all things. He's trusted everything to me, and you are his wife. I must not follow this path. And you read in Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24, search me, O God, and know my heart, and see if there be any wicked way in me. That word wicked is the word to wander. It's anything that diverges from the path that you have ordained for me. Psalm 37, mark the steps of that good man. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. The first criteria you must work through when you're making a decision is, am I judging by the surface of how this looks, or am I searching my heart? The real basis is on what's easy. And maybe this morning you'd say, well, Pastor Dan, I haven't had any Potiphar's wives lately. I'm glad there's not been any Potiphar's wives in your life. But have you made other choices just because it's easy? What did you choose to do with your time this last week? You had choices all week long. What did you choose to do? If you chose to do what was easy, then I guarantee you that choice of ease after choice of ease will eventually lead you down a path to where you'll find yourself wondering, how did I get to be like Judah instead of like Joseph? The paths of all of our lives are paved with the pebbles of those little choices of ease. But never forget what a pebble feels like in your shoe, because those easy choices eventually get in and they fester and they make your life miserable and full of regret. This choice of ease is something that that plagues us at every point of our life. Hey, young person, you can make the choice of ease with your schoolwork. Hey, it's easier to not memorize all these things. It's easier just to kind of scrape by as best as I can. It's easier to just kind of cut short my work and my development in school. It's easier to do that. I tell you what, that's going to catch up to you one day. Hey, it's easier at work if I just do what is necessary or what the guys are watching for, or if I make sure I do just the amount that's going to make sure that the boss is at least happy with me, that's easier for me. Did Joseph live by that motto? Not for a moment. Joseph looked at every choice. Is this what will bring honor to God? How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? I think what we're tempted to do in our life is to say, well, you know, Pastor, I'm not necessarily dealing with that level of immorality. I'm not deciding between those kinds of things. You know what? You may not be to that point yet, but I guarantee you the enemy will take notice, and one day that big decision may be right there. How do you prepare now for that day when that big decision will be there? You don't make the easy choice now. You make the hard choice. The choice that says, Lord, search me and know. What's the second criteria? The second criteria is a decision that's based on enjoyment. Substitute the heavenly instead of the satisfaction of appetite. Substitute the heavenly instead of the satisfaction of appetite. What did Judah do over and over and over again? Feels good. It silences the conscience. It makes my life more enjoyable. Boy, this is going to free me from all that's going on in my life. I don't have to deal with all that baggage and background. I can run away from it, and I can just make enough noise with the party and the enjoyment that I have in this life, and maybe it'll drown out all that I'm hearing that's speaking to me from my heart. And yet what we find is that Jacob looks to that dream. That dream, and we know that Jacob or Joseph has confidence in that dream, because in the next chapter, he's in prison. There's these two men that'll come into prison and they'll dream a dream one night. You know what? If Joseph didn't believe in that dream, you know what he would have told those two guys? Dreams. Those dreams don't mean anything. But that's not what Joseph says. Joseph comes to those guys. He says, well, tell me what you dream. The interpretation is of the Lord. And whatever you dream, the Lord's speaking to you, and he's going to bring it to pass. Let me hear your dream, and I'll tell you what the Lord is going to do. Joseph interprets those dreams. What does that tell me? That tells me that Joseph was one who had great confidence in the fact that what God said he would do in Joseph's life was what God would actually bring to pass. And why do I find myself in the point where I'm making two decisions, and I tend to decide to do what is enjoyable or what satisfies my appetite? It's because I don't believe God's best for me is really going to happen. If I believe that God's best for my life would really happen, then I'd live honorably for it. The reason why I choose an inferior choice, because I don't believe God is God enough to work in my life. How many statements run through your mind, friend, that disqualify you from serving the Lord? How many times do you hear that Satan's message? You aren't good enough. You've done so much. How could God ever use you? Look at all that other people aren't doing. Why do you need to keep going so hard and strong for God? Don't you deserve to take it easy? Why do you want to be such an industrious worker for a person that's so oppressive like Potiphar? How many lies do you think Joseph heard run through his head? And yet every morning he got up and he served Potiphar like he was the King of Kings. What's the difference? He believed God was going to do a great thing. And Joseph said, I'll prepare my life every day, because who knows, today may be the day that God desires to use me in a great way. The third criteria that I see that is based in Joseph, his decision versus Judah's decision. This decision is based on entitlement. Surrender in humility instead of the spirit of arrogance. Surrender in humility instead of the spirit of arrogance. This decision I've seen over and over in people's lives. And I've got to tell you, this is the one that's the killer. This is the last straw. This is the one that seals the deal. Pastor, you just don't understand. I'm not getting what I need, and so I deserve this. I'm not finding the satisfaction that I need at home, and so I deserve this. My needs aren't met financially, and so I deserve this. This is the direction that I have earned. It's a decision based on entitlement. Lest I'm mistaken, I'm entitled to nothing, because at the beginning of time, I, through my father Adam, disregarded God's instruction. And you and I have fallen so far short of the glory of God that you and I have earned only the wages of sin, which is death. And the only thing that is on my account is that this person is guilty before God. I deserve nothing but the pit of hell for all of eternity. There's nothing that I am entitled to. And so the lie of entitlement is what will creep into hearts to make you think you deserve something different than what you have. And the truth of the matter is, it's only by the grace of God that I do have something different than I deserve. I'm not entitled to it at all. I come humbly and say, Lord, I am so unworthy. Would you use me today, God? I don't know how you can use me today. I don't know how you can use me for your honor and your glory today, Lord. But Lord, I want to serve you with all my heart because you're a God who loves me. You're a God who gave his life for me. You're a God who moved heaven and earth for me. Lord, may my life today be characterized as one who's a servant in your hand. It's an honor today, Lord. And that's that spirit of humility, as opposed to that spirit of arrogance. You look at these two lives, Judah and Joseph, and you wonder what could ever happen with Judah. Look at the mess he's in. Look at what's going on with Judah. How's God ever going to bring out the promises he's put in Joseph's life? How can he ever use Judah? And how can he ever bring about what he promised in Joseph's life? But when you get to Genesis chapter 48, 49, Genesis chapter 50, friends, that is where you see the grace of God shines through in such an amazing way, because you see that Joseph is put in that position of authority. He's that ruler that Judah ran into when he went down to Egypt. He's that ruler that Judah was that threw Judah and his brothers into prison. Joseph is that ruler who's teaching and refining the qualities of something great within his brothers. Joseph, God brought to pass what he promised he would do in Joseph's life. What about Judah, though? What about Judah? In Genesis chapter 49, Jacob gathers all his sons together. Jacob is on his deathbed. He goes through and talks about Reuben. He doesn't bless Reuben. Verse 5, he speaks to Simeon and Levi. Doesn't bless them. But in the verse number 8, you see Judah. Thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Do you understand what Jacob just pronounced upon Judah? He says, Judah, you will be the kingly lion of all the sons of Jacob. Judah, the scepter will come to you. Judah, you will be held in great esteem. Judah, your brothers will call you blessed. Judah, you will rise up. How does Judah, the one who walked away from home, the one who wanted nothing to do with what his conscience was telling him he ought to have done, the one who rejected all, the one who had given up on the things of God, how does he go from that pit to all of a sudden the praise on the lips of his father? There came a point. We don't see the exact details of Judah's life, but we see every time that Judah speaks, from the moment he sold his brother into slavery until the moment he comes to Joseph and says, Joseph, don't take Benjamin. I'll give my life for Benjamin's. I sacrificed myself. Joseph, we are in this position. He doesn't know it's Joseph, but he says, we are in this position because the sins of our own life. We have made this choice. O ruler of Egypt, don't take Benjamin. Take me instead. And at that moment, you can recognize that he's a transformed man. Why? Because he's broken. He's broken. The title of this morning's message is We Are His Workmanship. If you're familiar with that phrase, you know it's coming from Ephesians chapter number 2. In Ephesians chapter number 2, we read the blessed story of what God does with you and with me. You read in verse number 1, Ephesians 2, He hath he quickened, who were dead in trespasses and sins, where in time past ye walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. Doesn't that sound like that each and every one of you and me live just like Judah? did our own thing. Repeatedly make the decision that's easy, enjoyable, and entitled. Verse number 4, but God, who is rich in mercy for his great love, wherewith he loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace ye are saved. Verse number 8, for by grace are ye saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them. I present to you two paths this morning. Which path are you on? If you're making choices in your life today that are easy and enjoyable and entitled, I don't care if you're with a Canaanite woman or if you have a whole mess on your hand. If you're making choices that are easy, enjoyable, and entitled, then I guarantee you you're on the path of Judah. And my caution to you this morning is wake up. Beware, because the path that Judah follows has great regret. But let me just encourage you. God is quick to respond to the repentant heart. God is quick to move and say, you are a broken and contrite heart. Lord, thou hast not despised ever a broken heart. And he rushes to your aid and he wraps his arms of grace around you and he takes you close and he says, my child, welcome home. I'm glad you're here. I can now quicken you in the ways of Christ. I can make you new. I can make you whole. I can bring you back to what you were designed to be. And all of a sudden, God has placed you as that trophy of grace where he can show the spectacle of his love in your life and in mine. I tell you that our desire should be to make the choices like Joseph did, to wake up every day and say, Lord, I don't know how you're going to use me today, Lord, but boy, am I excited. Lord, please keep me in the way of righteousness. Help me to avoid the path of temptation. Lord, help me to stay pure. Help me keep my eyes pure. I made a covenant with my eyes. I shouldn't ever consider or look upon another woman. Lord, I pray that you keep my mind clear. Lord, I pray that you help my hands to fulfill the task you have for me. Lord, let me be a good steward of my time and not allow one single moment to come between what I ought to do and what is meaningful for eternity. Lord, would you help me in every area of my life to consecrate myself as a servant for your glory today? If you and I will pray that way, we will never experience the regret of Judah, and we will only experience the blessing of God using a ready and meet servant. But you see, you have a choice. You have a choice. What is your choice today? I tell you that this morning, I want to encourage you, especially the adults, read through those chapters. Like I said, we highlighted and kind of hit the high points of those passages for very good reasons. But I think that what you'll find is God's grace is amazing. And why would I not choose to serve him with all my heart? The question today is choosing God's side. Are you going to choose God's way? Or are you going to make the choice that's easy, that's enjoyable, or that's entitled to you? Let's have every head bowed, every eye closed. Dear Lord, I pray that you'd help us to learn the lesson from Judah and from Joseph. What a powerful reminder it is, Lord, and that each and every one of us this morning are faced with that great divergence of paths every single day. Lord, I pray that this morning, if there's someone here that says, Pastor, I've been making choices of ease. I've been making choices of enjoyment. I've been making choices based on entitlement. I deserve this. I pray, Lord, that they would find that today is the day to be a broken person, a person that realizes those choices are going to lead to great destruction, great ruin, and great regret. And may today be that turning point. And much like Judah, at whatever point it is that their heart changes direction, that their desires change, that they will say, Lord, search me and know me. Try me and see if there be any wicked way in me. And may today be that courageous moment where they'll open up and allow you to direct their paths. Lord, I pray that we all would desire through the strength of the Spirit to follow in the steps of Joseph, to be able to make those decisions day in, day out, because the promises of God are so grand and glorious that you desire to do something great in and through each vessel that's willing and surrendered to serve your purpose. I pray, Lord, that that would be our driving motivation every single day, and what you would accomplish through each and every one of us as we yielded to your will in that manner. Lord, I pray that you'd have your way and your work in our hearts this morning. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Would you please stand?